Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really getting into a crucial topic, especially if you're revising for the ACCA financial reporting exam, the FR paper.
That's right. We're using the official ACCA FR syllabus and study guide, the one for September 2025 to June 2026.
And we're focusing in on Chapter 13, using that visual overview they provide too. It's all about impairment of assets.
Exactly. Our aim here is to really unpack the guidance on recognizing impairment losses. It's fundamental stuff for the balance sheet and, well, definitely something you'll see on the exam.
Absolutely. And it's not just about memorizing rules, is it? It's tested at intellectual level too.
Which means you need to apply these rules, analyze scenarios. It's about understanding, not just reciting.
So let's jump right in. What's the core idea? The visual overview mentions the objective is about recognition guidance.
Right. Think about impairment like this. Is the value of an asset on the company's books, its carrying amount, actually still justifiable?
Okay, so when isn't it justified? When is an asset actually impaired?
Well, simply put, an impairment loss occurs when the asset's carrying amount, its cost less accumulated depreciation, is more than what the company can realistically get back from using or selling it.
Ah, okay. That get back amount, that's the recoverable amount the study guide mentions.
Precisely. If your book value is higher than this recoverable amount, then, well, the asset's value is overstated in the accounts.
And you have to write it down.
Exactly. You recognize an impairment loss. Defining that, calculating it, accounting for it, that's a key skill outcome from the study guide B3A.
Got it. So carrying amount, recoverable amount equals impairment loss. But how often do companies check this? Is it just like a random check?
Good question. It's not random. The visual overview section when to test covers this. There are actually specific times you must test.
Oh, okay. Like when?
Well, certain assets need an annual impairment test every single year, whether you think there's a problem or not.
Which ones are those?
The big one everyone thinks of is goodwill. The goodwill you get from buying another company.
Right, goodwill. Because you don't depreciate it, so you need that annual check to see if it's still worth what you paid. Makes sense.
Exactly. But for most other assets, your factories, machines, even other intangibles, if they have a defined life, the test isn't usually triggered by the calendar.
So what triggers it then?
It's driven by what the standard calls indications of impairment. The study guide, B3C, specifically says you need to identify these circumstances.
Indications, like warning signs. What are we talking about here?
Could be external things. Maybe the market value of the asset has plummeted, or there are big negative changes in the economy or technology affecting it. Maybe interest rates have shot up, which impact calculations.
Okay, external factors. What about internal ones?
Sure. Things like obvious physical damage, the asset becoming obsolete, maybe management decides to sell it off early, or simply that it's just not performing as well as expected.
So you've got to keep an eye out for these signals, both inside and outside the company.
Yes. At the end of every reporting period, you assess if any indicators exist. If they do, then you perform the full impairment test. It involves estimation, judgment. It's not purely mechanical. The visual overview mentions that link to accounting estimates, too.
Okay, so let's say you spot an indicator, or maybe it's just time for the annual goodwill check. How do you actually do the test for, say, one specific machine?
Right, the impairment test for an individual asset. It's fairly logical, as the overview shows. You compare the asset's current carrying amount on the balance sheet.
To its recoverable amount.
Exactly. You compare those two numbers. If the carrying amount is higher, the difference is your impairment loss.
And we mentioned recoverable amount earlier. It's not just one single figure, is it?
No, that's key. It's defined specifically as the higher of two different values. You need to figure out both.
Okay, higher of two. What are they?
First is the asset's fair value, less costs of disposal. Think of it as what you could sell it for today in a proper sale, minus the direct costs of selling it, like agent fees, removal costs, that sort of thing.
Okay, the net selling price. What's the second value?
That's its value in use. This one's about keeping the asset, not selling it. It's the present value. So, discounted back to today's money of all the future cash flows you expect to generate from continuing to use that asset, plus any cash you'll get when you eventually dispose of it.
Right, so it involves forecasting future cash flows and discounting them. Sounds like estimation again.
It absolutely is. And the study guide mentions needing to compute amounts using these measures, fair value and value in use, that's outcome A2C influencing this.
So you calculate the net selling price, you calculate the present value of using it, and the recoverable amount is whichever one is higher.
Precisely. That higher figure represents the true economic benefit the asset currently offers.
Okay, let's use your example. Carrying amount is $100,000. Fair value less cost of disposal is $70,000. Value in use is $80,000.
So the recoverable amount is $80,000, the higher of the two.
And since the carrying amount, $100, is more than that, $80,000,
you have an impairment loss of $20,000.
And that $20,000 gets expensed in the profit or loss statement, and the asset's value on the balance sheet drops by that amount.
Correct. A direct hit to profit and the asset base.
Now, what if things turn around later? Maybe the market improves, or the machine starts working better than expected after you impaired it. Can you undo the loss?
Reversals. Yes, the study guide covers reversing impairment losses, too, under B3B for individual assets. If there's an indication that a previously recognized loss might have decreased or disappeared,
you re-estimate the recoverable amount.
You do. And if the new recoverable amount is higher than the asset's current carrying amount, the impaired value, you can reverse the loss.
So you write the asset's value back up.
You do. But there's a very important limit, often called the reversal cap.
A cap? What's that?
You can't reverse the loss to make the asset's carrying amount higher than what it would have been if you'd never recognized the impairment in the first place.
Ah, so you calculate what the carrying amount would be today based on its original cost and normal depreciation as if no impairment happened.
Exactly. That figure is the ceiling. You can reverse the impairment up to that ceiling, but no higher. You can't use a reversal to artificially inflate the value beyond its depreciated historical cost.
Okay, that makes sense. Prevents manipulation. Now, individual assets are one thing, but often assets work together, don't they? Like, one machine in a factory needs the rest of the line to actually make money.
Absolutely. And that's where cash-generating units, or CGUs, come in. The visual overview flags these for exactly that reason, and it's outcome B3'd in the study guide.
Cash-generating units. What exactly is a CGU?
The official definition is quite specific, but the core idea is it's the smallest identifiable group of assets that together generate cash inflows that are largely independent from the cash inflows of other assets or groups.
So you group assets together until you find the smallest bundle that essentially earns its own keep without relying heavily on other parts of the business.
That's the concept. Identifying the CGU, figuring out which assets belong to it, that's step one, as the overview shows.
And once you've identified the CGU, how do you test it for impairment?
The principle is the same as for an individual asset. You compare the CGU's total carrying amount, adding up the carrying amounts of all assets within it, to the CGU's recoverable amount.
And the CGU's recoverable amount is also the higher of its fair value, less costs of disposal, and its value in use. Just calculated for the whole group?
Correct. Calculated for the group as a whole. If the total carrying amount exceeds the recoverable amount, then the CGU as a whole is impaired.
Okay, so there's a CGU impairment loss. Where does that loss actually get recorded? You can't just take it off the CGU line item.
Exactly. This is critical, especially for exam questions linking to outcome B3E. You have to allocate that total CGU loss to the individual assets within the unit.
Allocate it. Just spread it evenly.
No, there's a strict order. Yep. First, you allocate the loss to reduce the carrying amount of any goodwill that's been assigned to that specific CGU.
Right. Goodwill takes the first hit. Always.
Always. If the impairment loss is bigger than the goodwill allocated to the CGU, or if there's no goodwill, then you allocate the remaining loss to the other assets in the CGU.
How?
On a pro rata basis.
Mm-hmm.
Based on the carrying amount of each asset relative to the total carrying amount of those other assets in the CGU.
Okay, so proportionally based on their book values. Is there another limit here?
Yes, similar to the reversal cap.
Mm.
When allocating the loss to these other assets, you cannot reduce the carrying amount of any single asset below its own individual recoverable amount, if you can determine it, or below zero, whichever is higher.
Wow, okay, so one, hit goodwill first. Two, allocate the rest proportionally to other assets. Three, but don't push any individual asset below its own recoverable amount or zero. That allocation order sounds like prime exam territory.
It absolutely is. Very common for calculation questions. And just like individual assets, the CGU impairment losses can potentially be reversed later if conditions improve, following similar principles, including checking against that overall would have been carrying amount for the CGU.
Right. This feels like quite a layered process judgment on indicators, specific rules for calculation, and these detailed allocation steps for CGUs. How does this translate into the FR exam itself?
Well, the syllabus makes it clear that you use both calculation and written, or discursive, questions. Impairment is perfect for testing both skills.
So calculations are pretty much guaranteed.
I'd say highly likely, yes. Calculating impairment losses, maybe for an individual asset, maybe for a CGU requiring that allocation process, calculating recoverable amounts, maybe involving a value and use calculation. These often appear in Section C's constructed response questions.
And the written parts, what might they ask?
They could give you a scenario and ask you to identify the impairment indicators, or explain why a certain group of assets constitutes a CGU. Or perhaps critique how management has accounted for an impairment. Is their approach correct according to IAS 36? Remember that level 2 assessment, apply and analyze.
So it's not just about crunching the numbers, but understanding the why behind them and being able to explain or justify the treatment?
Precisely. It's about applying that knowledge practically, which is what the FR exam is designed to test.
Okay, this has been a really helpful deep dive. We've covered what impairment is, when to test for it, the mechanics for individual assets, including reversals, and then the complexities of cash-generating units, defining them, testing them, and crucially, allocating those losses.
And mastering all the rules, the calculations like value and use, the judgment in spotting indicators and defining CGUs, it's really vital for FR. It's a cornerstone of accounting for non-current assets.
Yeah, understanding this definitely gives you a much clearer picture of how reported asset values can change and, well, why they change.
Absolutely. Which brings us to a final thought for you to consider. Given how much the calculation of value in use, a key part of that recoverable amount depends on management's estimates about the future. Things like future cash flows, discount rates.
Yeah.
How much could different assumptions, maybe slightly more optimistic or pessimistic views of the future, actually change the reported profit or loss in asset values of a company in any given year?
Wow. So just tweaking those future estimates could potentially make an impairment loss appear or disappear or change significantly.
They could have a massive impact.
Yeah.
So if these estimates are so important and, let's face it, subjective, what does that tell you about the importance of really paying attention to the notes, to the financial statements?
Where they have to disclose the key assumptions they made.
Exactly. The assumptions behind impairment tests. Something to think about as you study and when you look at real company accounts.
That's a great point to end on. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.